Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's the king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
We need an APB out for Rob Hovick. We can't find him anywhere. He hates us now, I think. He doesn't want to join our podcast with us anymore.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on. He really, he's a big golfer, huh? He just likes to get outside, and I don't understand. It's always 70 degrees and fluorescent. Why wouldn't you just play pool all year? I don't understand.
Yeah, that's just confuses me too. Big fisherman, big golfer, I guess. Definitely not a big podcaster, though. I've been trying to contact that guy for 3 whole days in a row, and he won't even respond to me. I'm just not important enough. So I guess it's Demetrius and I. Here we are. Everybody stuck with us. So let's get the stuff cleared up out of the way in the beginning. All right. To get the announcements out of the way in the beginning, we have a new Patreon to the podcast. Terry Horton, thank you so much for your generous support to the podcast. Terry Horton has had a listener question in the past, and he has also reached out along the way to help out with a couple of things for the podcast. So he's been a very valued listener since the beginning. So I really appreciate that, Terry, and I appreciate your support going forward. If you would like to become a Patreon as well, you can always head over to patreon.com/queueitup. The Patreon support helps us to basically continue doing what we're doing with the podcast and helps us to create content going into the future. All right, so we can leave that there. The next is we are going to try to do a big push to spread the podcast again. We have done these in the past, and they went pretty well, so I'm going to try to do them again because we're not really getting too much interaction or any sharing like that for the podcasts anymore. So we're going to try to give some incentive to help us get the podcast out to a larger group of people. So if you come across the podcast and you decide to share them, you'll be entered into a drawing, and at the end of probably next month or something like that, at the end of about 2 weeks or so, I will take all of those entries and I will actually draw a winner out of that. And I'm not 100% sure on what the prize is going to be yet, but I suspect it's going to be a Tyler Steyer signed ball as well as a couple of other things, maybe a hoodie or t-shirt, or I do have a lot of Q-Tech gear here, so maybe I'll give a couple Q-Tech t-shirts out or tip shaper or something like that. I need to think a little bit harder on what I'm going to do for prizes, but there'll be some pretty decent prizes for something that's pretty easy to do, just pressing the share button. And of course, every time that somebody shares them, we are able to get out to a few new people. So that would be awesome and a big help for anybody who's willing to do that. Lastly, I am going to put a poll up on the Facebook page, and I'm going to do this today. And basically, I'm trying to get some feedback on how many people listen to the podcast for whatever reason. So there'll be a couple options on there, like, do you listen to get information on how to get better? Do you listen as just entertainment? Do you listen for your way of keeping up to date with everything that's going on? And if you're interested and willing, we are going to use it for information in the future for a project that I might end up undertaking. So please go over there if you're willing to the Facebook page and give your answer to the polls. That would be really helpful to, I guess, start up this project if I decide to take it on. So I guess that's all. And now we can jump right into our shout outs. Would you like to go first, Demetrius?
Yeah. I was thinking about this and it's tough because there's just so many now I've got. But I'll tell you, I want to shout out to Harley Klimisch. He is a pool player that came up to train a little bit, and we had, I mean, gosh, I've been having a lot of fun these last few boot camps. And Harley's a great guy. He's from Iowa, and he works. He's got a really cool job. There's for anybody that's been through Iowa or anywhere in the upper Midwest, I guess I don't know what it's like in other parts of the country, but we have these windmill farms, where you've got these giant windmills that harvest, you know, wind power, of course, and convert it into energy. And so he's a supervisor. He's got like a huge swath of land where he's like responsible for the energy flow of a certain number of these things. And, you know, I didn't realize, so I got to learn a lot about how much energy they produce. And apparently, like, each windmill kicks out like $6,500 a day worth of energy. And so when you've got, you know, hundreds of these under your jurisdiction, you're responsible for quite a lot of energy flow. And so if the machines go down or if they're working suboptimally, whatever, he's got to, like, you know, open tickets, get technicians out there to troubleshoot, escalate if needed, get replaced parts. And, you know, he goes out and, you know, has some tricks of his own to kind of get these things working again. So he's out there taking, just kind of maintaining, you know, watching the dials and making sure that, you know, the energy is coming in. And if it's not, he's there to make sure it doesn't leak away. So it's a pretty cool job. But anyway, so he comes up and we're training together. We're really having fun. And it was really awesome to see kind of how he started hitting the balls once we worked on his game a bit. But, you know, I kind of give him a hard time because once in a while I'd be like, you know, I kind of give him a hard time because Minnesota and Iowa, we, I don't know, there's some long rivalry between, you know, being a little condescending towards each other. So anyway, at one point he had a shot down the rail. He had to cut a ball down the rail. It was like maybe a half an inch off the side rail. And I told him that I wanted him to play it with two rail speed, you know, come off that side rail, the other side rail, back to the middle of the table. I'm like, yeah, you play this with two rail speed. And he was really confused. And he's like thinking about like, you want me to hit it that hard? And he's thinking about it. And then he's like, oh, man, he's like, I wasn't counting the rail that it was sitting next to. I thought you wanted it to come across that rail, then all the way back to this rail, back to the middle of the table. And I'm like, yeah, I said, you know, I don't know how you guys do it down there on the old windmill farm. But up here, you know, up here, we count that first rail as the first rail, you know. So anyway, it just became this running joke where he'd be like, every time he did something wrong, he'd be like, I know. I don't, you know, down there on the old windmill farm. So anyway, we had a lot of fun, and I just wanted to shout out to my man Harley. So thanks for coming up. Good shooting, my friend.
Yeah. I will give my shout out to you, Demetrius, because you are going to let me do a boot camp with you in about 12 days. I'm excited. I can't wait.
I'm excited too, man. I've given it a lot of thought, and yeah, it's without saying anything, I don't want any spoilers because I want, you know, I don't want any spoilers, but I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm really looking forward to, for those that have heard, the way that this originally, my 3 days originally came about was going out with Josh and just kind of boot camping with Josh. And I'm actually going to be doing that. I just talked to Josh last night and we're lining up our annual, it's not even annual, we don't do it every year, but I'm lining up a 3 day with him where we're just going to go retreat and help each other as well. So I get to train too. He gets to help me on my game. So anyway, and I'm sure I'm going to learn some things from you. So I'm excited. I can't wait. And it's an honor to have you. And yeah, thank you.
It's going to be a good time. My game is going to get so much better. I might jump to like 4 Fargo points or something. And then I'll be able to see you from the mountaintop that you're on. I'll be close enough to be able to see you.
Jeez. You know, it's funny. Back when, you know, when I was, sometimes I joke around with people and sometimes like, you know, somebody would be talking, you know, I'd say something like, man, that guy would have to practice every day for 5 years for like 8 hours a day just to understand how much better I am. No, I'm just, it's just kind of a funny joke. But no, the fact is I'm really excited for you, Nate, because you are in a cool spot. And this is actually a tough bridge because right now you've been winning a lot of tournaments and you've been playing really, really well. And you're running out, you know, I mean, I've seen your videos and I haven't been to one of your trainings you've done. And I'm kind of curious to get an update there. I know you had one last night. But I know that you, like, I've heard you talk patterns. I mean, we've talked for hours listening to, you know, watching One Pocket together. Your knowledge of One Pocket, 8-ball, all makes so much sense. And you're just playing really good. You're executing well. You're winning tournaments. But there is it's a hard jump to make to running down amateur players on bar tables to when you start playing, like, you go to these pro tournaments on 9-foot tables and it's like, nobody cares that you run down, you know, it's like that you win local tournaments because everybody just runs out like water. And that's just kind of like the price of admission. And you're not like, that's not even good. That's just like, you know, that's just expected. And then, and then it's like, what else do you got? You know? And, yeah. And then you're sitting there surrounded by all these top players with their shiny shirts and patches and firepower. And it's like, it's just like, how do you get from, you know, winning bar table tournaments against, you know, against local players to like break it through. And it's a tough gap. And you know what? It's a gap that most people don't make. And I want you to make it because I'm like, you know, I just think that pool is a fun game. And yes, you can promote pool and you can build a pool community and provide good pool content, but that doesn't mean that, that you should have to put your love of the game second, because it's, you play a really, really good game and you deserve to have it come together at a high level. So I can't wait, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. All right. So with all of these shout outs out of the way in the beginning, we can just jump right into inserting our foot in our mouth, because we were both wrong big time.
Yep. Eat a little crow. Well, you know what? That's actually going to tie into my coach's corner later. But anyway, yeah, we never claimed though. We never claimed that we'd always be right. But you know what? The other thing is though, is that, just because you book a loser doesn't mean you're wrong either. Right. Like even if you get your money in ahead, like if you play poker and you get your money in with aces against, you know, eights, or even I think it was the 6-7 suited or whatever the best hand is to crack aces. Yeah, you're going to win 80% of the time, but there's a good 20% of the time you're going to get wrong, even if you get your money in good. So just because you lose doesn't mean that you got your money in bad. And so even if we always called the right side of it in terms of matchups, that doesn't mean we're not going to book some losers. However, I do think this is a case where we might have just flat out picked the wrong side. So either way, though, but either way, it's like, you know, the only way to not lose ever is to never bet. But I'd rather bet and win. As long as we can win the majority, I think we're doing okay. So far, yeah. We're doing okay. So, yeah.
So I guess that's pretty obvious at this point for anybody that's listening. Chip Compton wins 24-16, and that looks like a huge gap, but it actually was a one-game gap going into day three. And then Chip wins the first game. Roberto wins the second, so it is 17-16. And then Chip wins the next seven straight. And that was a little misleading. I think Roberto had a lot of opportunities in there, and he, for whatever reason, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I've been reflecting on this one for a lot the last few days. Roberto, I think, had something go on between day two and day three. He looked like a completely different player from day two, where he looked like he was grinding, you know, actually trying to put his head down and get back into this match, to day three, where after game number one, where it lasted an hour and a half, and he ended up losing because he shot a stupid shot, basically, at 7-7 tied up. After losing his first game in 7 hours, he kind of battled back, but then hit another silly shot in the third game, and then he didn't even look like he could be bothered to be there at that point in time. I mean, he was shooting ill-advised shots. He was jacked up, firing at shots 50 miles an hour, which anytime you jack up in one pocket, you know it's generally not going to end very well. And he was just shooting a bunch of shots that just didn't look like the Roberto that I know as a one pocket player. What were you thinking from there?
Yeah, it's tough because we've already talked about this because we were watching this for hours together and talking amongst ourselves. But you know, if I were to select some of the things that I said that as far as this match goes, it's, you're right. I mean, I just, there are certain mistakes. And certain, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do in one pocket that don't have to work. You know, when you're trying two-way shots, they don't have to work. When you're up, you know, 5-2 on ball count and you're taking a little bit of a gamble where all the balls are up table, and if you make a mistake, it's likely only to cost you one or two balls, you can push the gas a little bit. There's a lot of times when you have time to be creative and aggressive, but there are times when you just don't get to make huge blunders. And so, like, there was a couple. And so just to start with the first one you're talking about, and Roberto gets a shot where the object ball gets spotted and he's up by his, the top corner on his side of the table, but he's not in the jaws. He's actually like maybe half a diamond or even maybe a diamond out from the corner. So he's got a legitimate chance to cut this ball in his pocket. And he undercuts it to the end rail and the cue ball scratches. And yeah, he scratches on that shot. And then actually was that, and I might be wrong on this, but then he left the ball up on his side rail. Was that the time then when he spotted the ball and now Chip needs one?
Correct.
Was that one Chip that liked to pass on the spot shot and go for the cross bank on the loose ball?
Yep.
Okay, and so we actually talked about this, and this is something I learned from Bull Runnigan, and this actually ties right into what I was saying about Roberto's shot. So for Roberto, if you're going to shoot at that ball, you know, which I don't mind shooting at that ball, especially when you're a great player. But the thing is, you've been playing, you've been shooting that ball for, you've been playing safe, you've been playing this game for an hour. And so in a vacuum, you could sit there and say, well, I'm a good player. This is a, you know, back cut spot shot length of the table. I should be able to get that near my hole and make it, you know, a third of the time. But in those circumstances, and not only have you been playing this game for an hour, but you've been playing this match for days. And when you've been playing this game for an hour and this match for days, and this shot is going to be a slippery tipping point in the momentum and the outcome of a three-day match, like, you've been playing for 3 days to get here. You don't want to just scream off this ball and go in the corner. Like, that's not what you get to do. And so if you're going to shoot that, as we know, you're better missing the entire ball and having the second ball spot up and, you know, need both of them, but at least they're tied up on the spot. And if you're going to hit it, you got to play to overcut it. And I know that what he's doing by undercutting it, he was like, he's up there. Here's what he's thinking. He's thinking, I'm not going to just get up there and overcut this ball to my pocket like a wimp because I'm afraid of scratching or selling out. I'm Roberto Gomez, and I'm going to win this match because I'm going to go ahead and aim thick at this ball and cut it right in the heart of my pocket. And it's like, well, okay, but you just, the penalty for making that mistake is so big. And so then meanwhile, the ball, he banks the ball up to his side rail, maybe around the second diamond, maybe a ball without the rail. A ball spots on the foot spot, and now Chip has ball in hand, and he needs one. And he could shoot the open spot shot, but instead, he elects to try to cross bank Roberto's ball off his side rail. And you and I were talking about this, and this is actually something that Bull Runnigan from, he lives in LA now, but he taught me this back in Minnesota. He likes that shot. He likes to cross bank the loose ball instead of taking the spot shot on. And here's why. If you miss that spot shot and sell something out, your opponent just blundered. He needs both balls. If you get up and choke and miss a spot shot, he gets to tap in two balls. That's a huge penalty. Whereas if you cross bank that loose ball and leave the ball in the spot alone and just send a cue ball up your opponent's side rail, if you miss the cross bank, you've got a ball near your pocket, you know, and the guy's got to play defense, and you're going to get more shots, and he needs both balls, and there's not really a penalty. And so even though the spot shot is easier to make, is it really easier to make when you have that type of pressure on you where you know if you miss this, like, there's just so much of a penalty that meanwhile that cross bank is so pressure-free that even though – if you just, you know what I'm, you hear what I'm saying, you take all the pressure off by choosing the cross bank, and then it's good game management, because then you can actually deliver a good stroke more often, you actually make it almost as often, and then when you miss it, you still win the game most of the time. And so Chip elected to cross bank the ball, he didn't make it, and then he went on to win the game. And I might be wrong, maybe that was a different game, I thought that was what happened.
That was the game.
And so my point is, Chip, that was a very... that was a very good metaphor or a very good example of what happened there, which is that Chip used great game management, and he knew that, yes, you want to be aggressive. Yes, you want to push the gas pedal, but there are certain mistakes at certain times that you don't get to make if you want to win one pocket matches. And Roberto was just kind of in Josh Filler aggressive mode.
Well,
and
if I can expand upon
he allowed himself to make the mistakes that cost him the match.
Yeah, if I can expand upon that, because this was going to be my next point. Chip Compton, from what I saw, went into this match literally looking to execute a game plan. And my what I saw him do is not his normal quote-unquote one-pocket game. I thought I saw him do things that it really looked like he had a set game plan coming in, that he was going to play the long game. He was never going to take on that 50-50 shot. He was never going to take on that crazy backswing and let the cue ball go three rails or something like that into, you know, a safe area. He was just going to play the conservative 65-year-old guy, I play one pocket six times a week, safe shot that never, you know, it never really gets you anywhere productive, but it doesn't get you in a bad place either. And that is an extremely effective strategy if the person you're going against isn't playing that.
and doesn't have the firepower to make these shots. So Tony Choan, for example, when he was playing filler, he wasn't playing that way, but he wouldn't have been able to even if he wanted to. I mean, Joshua Filler was just making shots that just make you scratch your head.
I've actually, when you were talking about Compton's game plan, and I'm going to let you continue, I was thinking about, Filler and Choan, and I was actually, maybe it's not Tony's style, and he might not have been able to optimize that style, but I think that a player of Choan's speed could have played that style against Filler and not necessarily just been completely like, oh, I'm just going to wedge everything up table. But I do think that he could have played a more effective style and that trying to challenge Filler on just firepower and aggression might not have been the right strategy. So anyway, how it might have worked out is debatable. It might have worked out. It might not have. Yeah, continue.
So I guess going back there, I really saw Roberto do – he really fell into those aggressive traps that Chip was laying out for him. It seemed like he was trying to give him shots that, like, there's no way Roberto's going to shoot this shot. All right, let's give it to him and see if he will. And he didn't always, but he took a lot of those on, and he missed most of them. And even the ones that he did make, he wasn't really getting out of. He was getting 2, 3, 4 balls out of it and then, playing safe again and then just getting out moved later on in the match. The perfect example of this was, I believe it was at 17-16, and Roberto is up 7-1 on the count. And Chip just...
I think that came a little later because that was a big, big, big pivotal swing. And I wanted to, yeah, I thought was it was, I thought
maybe
it might
it was
have
18,
been like a 3 game. It might have been like 19-16 where he's up 7-1. And it's like, if he can't put him away from up 8 balls and he's going to fall 4, or it might have even been 20-16. It was like a must win game for Roberto. He was already down 3 games at least. And he had to finish that game. Go ahead.
Okay, maybe it was. I think it might have been 18-16. But
it might have been 18-16. Yeah. It might have been 18-16. That could have been, yeah.
Yeah, it could have. Whatever it was. And Roberto basically just slowly gives back it because he keeps trying these crazy shots and leaves, he'll try to take on this 25-30% shot, and then he sells out a 50% shot. And Chip just slowly chips away, no pun intended, towards this lead, and next thing you know, it's knotted up 7-7, and Roberto scratches. And so now Roberto goes from being up 7-1 to being down 7-6. And of course, the game lasted about 6 seconds after that. But that's like the perfect example of what I saw Chip doing in the entire session, was just sticking to a game plan of trying to tease Roberto into these crazy shots and selling out a better opportunity. So if you can sell out a 20% shot and get a 40% shot in return, that's over the long run, that's going to be much more valuable towards winning a set like this. And I think the frustration of that happening over and over and over again was prevalent on day 3. And I think that's a lot of what happened with Gomez. He just seemed to not give up, but I mean, he just started shooting even more crazy shots like he was on tilt.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to spend just a moment defending Roberto, because then I'm going to spend a little bit more time tearing him apart. No. But in a couple things in his defense. First of all, pressure, money match, coming down the finishing stretch, that's a lot of pressure. And no matter who you are, it's startling. It can be startling for people that have never been really, really under that kind of heat. It's hard to understand sometimes how tough the game can get and how weird it can go. And when you're on a stream and you're playing somebody for days and all of a sudden the finish line's coming down the stretch, like there's times when pressure can just overwhelm you and you just play bad. And so that can happen. And then the other thing is that if you feel like you're getting outplayed in one pocket in particular, 9 ball's a little different. 9 ball, even when you're getting beat, like, at least you kind of know how to play the game. You kind of know what the goal is. But there's times in one pocket when you're adjusting your game plan and everything you're trying to do doesn't seem like it's working. And it can make you feel desperate. It can just make you feel like my best game isn't good enough. And you start having to swing for the fences or trying to, like, you just don't know what to do. And so when you're losing playing one pocket, sometimes it's just you don't know what to do. You get lost. And so between pressure and being beaten and Chip's strategy working really well. And then, of course, but I would say this, is that Roberto's used to being able to make certain balls at certain make percentages playing 9 ball. But again, you go to one pocket and you put so much pressure on yourself on a couple of shots that you're taking on, because the penalty of these is so high. I mean, you're betting a 3-day set and then all the money you're betting on this shot, you know what I mean? It's just so much. I don't know, man. It seemed like it changed things. So in his defense, it was a lot of pressure. But yes, Chip's strategy was one. And I said this to you. I said, you know, when you're playing one pocket, there's nothing better than playing against an opponent that does something stupid every 5 to 10 shots. Because yep. When you're playing it against an opponent who you know is frustrated and going to do something stupid every 5 to 10 shots, you don't have to try to force anything. All you have to do is survive for 5 or 10 innings until they do something dumb, and then you just penalize them for it. And I've been in that spot where I'll be playing with somebody. That's happened many, many times, and I've probably been the giver on the other side of this too when I'm up against it, where I'll be playing somebody. We'll go back and forth for a while, then I'll start getting up 4, 5, 6 games, and then pretty soon they start tilting and getting frustrated, and all I have to do is just get up there, game manage, not do anything dumb, keep some pressure on them, keep the balls in play, keep giving them opportunities to do things wrong, and all I have to do is just play ABC one pocket, and they'll self-destruct, and then I just run balls out, and I just play a real ABC game and watch them explode. And then that's what Chip did, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was, yes, I that's pretty much what I saw as well in the grand scheme of things. It just seemed like Chip was doing, just keeping the balls in play, keeping them over on his side as best he can, and allowing Roberto to just kind of go crazy on a shot and give up a pretty, maybe not an easy one, but, you know, a shot that Chip's going to take on and be happy to take it on kind of shot. So
yeah, and then there was a couple times that Roberto got to run some balls, and here is the problem, you know, this is a big one-pocket cardinal rule is, if you're playing one pocket and you have balls open and balls, maybe a ball hanging in your pocket, and you finally trap your opponent, and the last couple games where you trapped your opponent, they kicked your ball in or wriggled out of it, and now this time you finally earned a shot, whether it's you finally got a chance to shoot a hanging ball or you finally won yourself a free bank and you made that bank. It is imperative that you walk back to your chair at the end of that inning as a favorite. And so what I mean is, if the ball count is, say it's 1-1, and you've got a ball hanging and you trap your opponent, they leave you a shot. You do not get to get up and shoot your ball in and run 2 or 3 balls, get out of line, fire at something, miss, and spread the balls open. Like, when you finally get that chance to score, if you run 2, 3 balls, do something dumb, and turn the table over to your opponent, that is one of the most, there's a high penalty for that, because you just don't get that many opportunities to be in that position. And if you give that, if you not only, like, the second worst thing to do, okay, the second worst thing to do is to get 1 ball out of it. You know, so it's 1-1, you get up and shoot your hanging ball, try to play position, run into the back of something else and end up only getting 1. That's really, really bad. But at least you can play safe from there and end up, you know, at least you got 1 and you can play a good save and try to keep the initiative. Now, that's really, really bad. And by the way, when I teach one pocket, I make a point of talking about how to get out of the hanging balls, if you can get on the other side of the open balls from a hanger, and that's a really, really important thing. People see this ball hanging, they think, oh, I'll just shoot it in, get out there, but it's like, no, you have to understand your entire match might depend on your ability to get on the other side of this picket fence of balls. Like, this is getting the cue ball on the other side of that picket fence of balls is like shooting the 9. You have to find a way through that you can do, take this transition really seriously. But now you've done that, you're running balls, you have to leave that table as the favorite. Meaning, even if you only run 3 or 4 balls, I'd rather have Gomez run 3 or 4 balls, play a good safe, stay in control of the table, and go back to his chair up 5-1 in initiative, you know, with a successful inning. And, you know, that's so important, because even, like, listen, if you walk back to your chair and you've got your opponent down 5-1 and you ran some balls and you had a productive inning and a successful inning, that is so important that if you then push to try to get 1 or 2 more balls, rip the rack open and leave your opponent a shot where he can run balls and neutralize it. It's like, it's just such a big swing. And it's a big swing in terms of, it got to the point where it's as good as Roberto plays. It got to the point where, when he finally did get a chance to run balls, I felt like he was even money to squander the opportunity and give it back to Chip somehow because he was pushing so recklessly. And I just feel like when you do get a chance to run balls, you need it to be so that every time you run the balls, like, I mean, of course, you're a human. Something's going to go wrong once in a while. But it can't feel like it's even money that you're going to, like, you finally get a chance to run balls. It can't be 50-50 as to whether this blows up in your face. You have to run the open balls you can, play a good safe, keep control of the table. And he wasn't doing that. So not only was he giving Chip a lot of opportunities by pushing the gas too hard in their moving battles, but even when he did get a chance to shoot balls, I felt pessimistic that he would. I just felt like when he finally did get a chance to start his run with a hanging ball, I felt like it's 50-50 whether or not Chip's going to get a chance to shoot at his pocket here in about 30 seconds. Yeah. That's how it felt watching.
So let's take a step back now and kind of look at the broader, the broader outlook of one pocket players at this time. I had said that I thought Roberto was probably, for my money, the fourth best in the world at that point, maybe short of the wild card of Joshua Filler. What does this actually mean as far as the shaking up of that rankings?
I want to just say one last thing about Chip that'll actually add to that rankings. So let me just insert one thing about Chip. I like Chip's strategy. Chip was not complete. When I say he was ABC, that's a little bit dismissive. He played, in my opinion, he played phenomenal one pocket because he did run a lot of 8 and 9 and outs. He was running the balls very well. He was striking the balls very well. He did not miss many balls in his pocket. He was, you know, whether it was long shots, shots down rails, elevated shots, he really was in control of his game and his run out game. He was running the balls very well.
Yeah. Well, he was. And the only time I saw him struggle, if I can jump in there real quick, the only time I ever saw him struggle was initially out of the gate in day three, about the first 5 games. And he won 4 or 5 of those. I mean, I saw him miss probably – he probably averaged 2 shots per game that he actually missed, and they were bad misses, what I would consider bad misses in one pocket. That was the only time that I really saw him struggle in this match, and it didn't really mean anything. I mean, Roberto couldn't put anything together to really start challenging him. And, even when you're playing bad, he was still able to
– they might have been the misses you can get away with, not the misses you can't get away with.
Yes,
kinda.
They were.
And then in addition to him running the balls well and pocketing the balls well, he was moving well. His cue ball speed was good. But beyond that, the one thing that was really impressive to me, and I'd already talked to you about this, but I want the listeners to hear it. He didn't do anything stupid for such a long stretch of time. And actually, after, like, you know, I'm not sure that I ever really saw Chip do anything where I'm like, well, this is just asking to lose. Like, I never, and for the entire day three, and I don't know if it took 5 hours or what it took, but when you play one pocket with people, most one pocket players, there's a rhythm where it's like you shoot good for a while and then you do something stupid and you walk back to your chair and you bang your cue and be like, I can't believe I did that. Oh, man, that was stupid. I wish I could have that shot back. And then the other guy plays good for a while, and then he does something stupid. And you're like, ah, ha, ha, you did something stupid. Now I get the mop up. And most players kind of take turns doing stupid stuff. And, you know, it's almost like this gentleman's agreement where we're both going to play pretty hard, but, you know, we'll just make some mistakes we'll both make some blunders and shot selection here and there so that we can get to try some fun, creative stuff. And I'll just talk Chip. Chip, it was clear he made up his mind to say, you know what? I have the discipline to go and say to myself, I am not going to have one shot where I go back to my chair kicking myself. I'm going to have shots that don't work. I'm going to have shots that fail. I'm going to give Roberto some opportunities where I can't stop him. But I'm not once going to make a shot selection. I'll just speak for myself. I've used this as a pre-shot routine in one pocket. If I'm making a decision on aggression, if I'm making a decision on something that's a little bit, you know, aggressive or a little bit exposed, I'll ask myself, if this shot doesn't work out and my opponent comes to the table and starts running balls, am I going to be kicking myself going back to the chair? Or am I going to go down with the ship and feel like, well, you can't always stay with 100% shots in one pocket. This is the price of battle. Like, if I feel like it's a good risk and I'm at peace with the fact that this won't work some of the time, then I'll go with my gut and I'll go with my decision. I'll put my best swing on it and I'll live with the consequences. But I have had sessions where I've made up my mind to say, I refuse to make a shot that I'm not content with. And it takes a lot of discipline. I've played a lot of one pocket players and not many of them can do that. It's one of the things I'm strong at is I can game manage really well. And when I saw Chip, who, when I knew Chip, my first time I played him in 2008, I played him in a one pocket match. I gambled with him playing some, you know, some nine ball sets. You know, I know Chip. And back then he was this young freewheeling straight shooter. And when I saw him game manage as well as he game managed in terms of just not making any blunders, like to cut out all the blunders, like not some of them, not most of them, not rarely, but just he was capable of playing a 5-hour session against a Filipino champion, one of the best of the world, and not making any blunders. To me, the amount of composure that took and the amount of focus, not just discipline, but the focus to execute the discipline. In those conditions on day three, I'm telling you, I was really impressed. I don't think I've seen that level of composure from anyone short of Alex Pagulayan. And Chip, you know, you're talking about rankings. So, you know, Chip, I'll tell you what, didn't he beat Scott Frost when they played last time?
Yeah, he beat him pretty bad. I know he played, I think they played a 7-ahead and Chip won it in 9 games. So
the other
Scott
thing about Chip is that he seems like he kicks up his game. I remember he played, this is probably 6-7 years ago, he played Larry Neville that 7-ahead, and they seesawed for a while, and then they counted it all up and played a race to 7 at the end, and Chip just lit it up. And I'm telling you, Chip seems like he knows how to win, so he plays phenomenal pool, but then he just knows how to put his game together to win, which I'll tell you, I'm starting to think that I don't know how, maybe I didn't overrate Gomez. Maybe I just didn't give Chip credit. You know, in my mind, he was kind of in that, you know, Danny Smith, you know, and not even, I don't even know if I had, maybe Justin Hall. I mean, you got all these kind of like, you know, I don't know, man. I don't know where to put him anymore. He's playing. I'll just tell you this. I was blown away by how well Chip played. And so when it comes to taking Roberto down to the rankings, you got to be careful because part of it could just be that Chip is playing super strong right now.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was going to say, too, is maybe Roberto, although I will say this, Roberto had a huge flank exposed in this match. Something that's very easy to work on. It's just a matter of, you know, staying patient and not, you know, kind of selling out the shot, right? But I think when I'm thinking the best one pocket players in the country, I'm thinking Tony Chohan. And then I'm kind of thinking from like Tony, I kind of think is a little bit on his own. But then I'm looking at a big collection of players, including Justin Hall, Josh Roberts, Jeremy Jones to a kind of a lesser degree now. But, you know, before.
Where do you put Billy?
Billy, to be honest, I haven't seen a lot of Billy play one pocket. I really haven't. The only time I've ever seen him play one pocket is at Derby. So yeah. I really can't comment too well on that one. Okay. And then and Chip Compton, I always had in that kind of group too. Now I kind of think it might be Tony. I would love to see Tony and Chip play. I mean, I think they played about a year ago or something like that, but I would like to see it again on a big stage. And, you know, I mean, I think it'd be fun. I think it'd be a really good matchup to see.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I just watching what I've watched is, and I'm really high on Chip's game right now, but I don't think he gets there with Joanne. I think that
to be fair though, we didn't think he's going to get there with Gomez.
Yeah, no, I understand, but I also see how it played out, and I don't think that Chohan would make the blunders and give him the opportunities, and that if it, you know, they were dead even after 2 days, and it took him day three and a lot of blunders from Gomez for him to get that lead and put it away. I don't know that he's going to like it against Cho. I just, my gut tells me that he's not going to like it. Now, to be fair, it's not, yeah, you know, to be fair, it's one of those things where maybe, you know, Chip can play. It's hard because his opposition was only, you know, if Gomez plays poorly, and then Chip wins handily. Maybe Chip didn't even get to show how strong he is. Maybe if Gomez played better, Chip would have played even better and more dominant, and we would have seen even another level. But I've seen Chohan enough to know that, I mean, he's, you know, I mean, just he's playing with the absolute elites of the game and taking a set off Dennis and putting the heat on Alex and just blowing away everyone else he plays. And I don't know, man. But you're right. That would be a fun match to watch. But I don't know where Chip is. It's hard. It's hard when you start getting to that level. Obviously, matching up one pocket is very, very challenging when you get to these levels. I was really impressed by his moving, by his composure, and by his discipline and just everything Chip did. But I've just seen Tony play where a lot of those shots that Gomez shot at that didn't work out, he wouldn't have shot at those shots. He would have shot at other shots that would have been very difficult for you can't play ABC against Chohan and have it hold up. That's what I'm trying to say. Like when Alex has beat him, and he hasn't been playing ABC. He's been playing a really, really high level game. And Chip, if he plays Chohan, he can't just sit there and play ABC and wait for the guy to make mistakes, because here's what happens then. You just don't put enough heat on your man, and he's going to have balls moving towards his pocket every shot, and you're going to be digging out of there and trying to just buy, you know, pretty soon you're just trying to take out balls and survive, and you're always the one on your back foot, and Chohan's always finding ways to, you know, you take out balls and defend two out of three times, but then the third time you sell out a length of the table bank, and Chohan makes it and runs four more balls, and you're always behind on ball count, and he's always got the balls in play. Trust me, ABC don't win against that. It's just a hell of a long night, and I think that that's what would happen if they played.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I give more credit to Tone, or I give more credit to Chip than that, though. I think Chip played and executed a game plan against Roberto that was very clear, it was very concise, and it was very calculated. And I don't think that that has to be Chip's game. I think that Chip can kind of switch around the. I think Chip can kind of switch around his game plan, and I think he can go at Tony in an entirely different way. So I kind of like the matchup still, and I think he's got a pretty good chance with the shooting that I saw. But we don't have
to. I would love to see it.
Yeah, I would love to see it. So we can leave this discussion there. I guess we're both kind of we want to see a little bit more of Chip, and I think we're both kind of at the consensus that he deserves a little bit more respect towards being in those top tier of players than maybe we had given him, or I shouldn't say the top tier, but kind of that second tier that we previously had thought. So I think that's kind of where we're both at.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I always kind of thought that on the U.S. side that there was Tony and then, you know, Josh Roberts and Billy Thorpe and Justin Hall. And I think that the Chip's right in there for sure. And, you know, if he doesn't get there with Tony, I think that watching him play Billy Thorpe would be a fun match. That's my opinion. Like him against Billy or him against Justin Hall. I think those would be really fun games to see.
Yeah. So we can leave this discussion there and we can move on to our upcoming events. So there has been a one-pocket matchup announced. There are not dates yet for it, but it is going to be between Scott Frost and Tony Chohan. So I guess going back to one of the best one-pocket players about 10 years ago and who we think is the best one-pocket player right now, this is going to be a Pool Action TV production, 3-day match, race to 24, stopping at 8:16:24. So the same exact format we just saw with Chip Compton and Roberto Gomez. I don't want to speak for you, but I don't even – one, there's no dates announced, so there's not a huge reason to talk about it. But I don't think there's a lot of reason to talk about this one regardless. I'm not sure exactly what's going on in Scott's head, but I just don't see this being a match. Maybe you think it is more, but I just think this is a runaway.
Yeah, it's when Scott was on top of his game, playing all the time, playing, you know, a lot of action matches against Efren and Alex, you know, he could have definitely, I mean, Scott can obviously play great one pocket. There's no way to say this, like, with all due respect, I don't think that he has what it takes right now to beat Tony. I think he could play some great games. He can make some great moves. He can make some great runs. But in terms of like game after game, steadily all day, Tony's playing higher level and more in stroke. So yeah, I think we're on the same page.
I think if they played this, I mean, just I don't even think it has to be within. I don't think it has to be within eight games. I don't think it does. I mean, maybe it does, and maybe we're just, you know, maybe Scott's been playing a little bit more than what we know, and he's feeling good and he's stroking them straight, and you know, maybe brings it down to the wire. But I just. From the last time I saw Scott's game against Chip, that game isn't going to do him any good against the way that Tony's matching up against everybody and anybody and everybody, and you know, really out there playing the game right now. So I think that this is a runaway. But
We can also talk about the match that I wanted to spend a lot of time on. And this one is going to be Dennis Arroyo and Sky Woodward with 30,000 in the middle. And this is the first time we've had, I think, a real, real pool session that is world-class quality appointment viewing since the shutdown, in my mind anyways.
Well, we had Aranis and Filler, but yeah.
That was like a week into the shutdown, I think. Yeah, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and even that, I mean, that's a really fun event, right? But there was no question on who was going to win that. And maybe that's where we're at here, too. I don't know. But, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to say James Aranis is like, oh, my God, this guy could probably win this match. I mean, that was not an exhibition, but it was kind of, well, Joshua Filler's a different breed. I mean, that dude is a different cat.
Aranis played pretty sporty and got a lead on day one. And, I mean, tell you what, you're right. I don't think that there was any chance he was winning. But for a guy who was drawing dead on paper to play that good and take a lead on day one, and to get ahead of Filler to 33 games is pretty impressive. But anyway, yeah, your point being said, it wasn't as the one thing about that particular match that we talked about at the time is Aranis didn't have any edge in that match to where it was really hard to debate who was going to win. Whereas in this match, I think Sky is going to have a couple things on his side.
Before we get into it, though, let me give all the details for the match, just so that everybody can know exactly what we'll be talking about. This is going to be a 9-ball race to 100, 9-ball racked on the spot. That's going to be important. Winner break, AccuStats rack from the box. You have to break from the box. Race to 35 each day. This is going to be a pay-per-view by Rackham TV, and this is going to be on a diamond table with 4 1/4-inch pockets. Rack your own. No checking the opponent's rack, and there is a 3-point rule on the headstring where made balls do count. So that is basically the breakdown of the match. If you want to take it away first.
Yeah, so to me, this one's if we wanted to talk about the strengths of each player in this one and who's got edges at different parts of the game. Of course, the first thing people think is, well, Dennis, higher Fargo rate, way more experienced in gambling matches, considered to be an elite top five in the world for the last 15 years. It might seem lopsided at first because right away, all the major edges, the striking edge, the safety and moving edge, the kicking edge, all of this goes to Dennis. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, maybe everything short of banking and jumping. Yes.
Okay, that's actually, I wasn't thinking banking, and actually after watching Dennis play one pocket and watching Dennis bank, it's hard to give anyone a banking edge, but I will tell you this, when it comes to jumping and breaking, yeah, so obviously Dennis has all these edges, and it seems like, well, how is Sky going to fight back, and why would he agree to this? But then, the thing that gets me is that the template rack with the 9 on the spot, Sky breaks that particular rack better than anyone I've seen.
So
the first time I saw this was at the 2018, International Open 9-ball, whatever. I thought it was 2018. Maybe the years are blending in my head. But he came out, and I'm pretty sure, he came out and he was breaking the wing ball in. He was making the 1 of the side, and he was making that 2-ball go 3 rails and sit in front of the side pocket to where he had like, I think he was down on somebody like 9-1 or 10-1 in a race to 11. And he came back and won 8 racks in a row where he made the 1 of the side and played shape, 3 rails for the 2-ball in that side pocket, 7 or 8 breaks in a row. And I had never seen, that particular break before. That's why I remember, like, how can you be playing the 2-ball, 3 rails to sit in front of a side pocket? He had that thing down to a shot. And then I saw him with the same format do the same thing at Derby in the following January in 2019. And I think he won the 9-ball because of that break. And I got to see him use that break and just devastate everybody. And so when I hear that, this is where, it's hard for me to not kind of gripe about this, which is that, we're definitely not going to go down this road, but I heard the podcast that you guys did talking about the breaking controversy of pattern racking that went on in a recent event. I'll tell you what, it's pretty appalling to me that this is what our matchups come down to is, this template, you know, solving template racks with, you know, with different breaking rules and different patterns. I can't even start talking about it because I think it's pretty silly that we take elite athletes that have spent their life working on these skills of moving and running out, and that we're going to just come down to so much of it. Like Dennis has so much in terms of skill, but it might all be neutralized because of Sky's break shot. And I personally don't really care for that. But that being said, that's what's going on. Sky has a huge break advantage when it comes to that template. He does jump really well. He is playing extremely well, striking the balls well, and he wants to establish his presence. And so this is his opportunity to fight back. So that's what I see. Dennis has the experience, the striking, the moving, and then the, you know, just the higher firepower probably. And then Sky's got the break, the jump, and that young drive to success.
Yeah.
That's what I see. So anyway, we're getting sidetracked because that's a very small role in this matchup. What else do you think of this matchup with Sky and Dennis?
Yeah. So basically what you said, I agree with all of it as far as the edges. Okay. So let me ask, I don't want to go too much further in that because there's not too much more I can add, basically, is what I'm getting at. But I think that Dennis, the edge that Sky has over Dennis on the breaking department and the edge that Dennis has over Sky in the shooting department, I mean, those are the huge edges. And that's really what we're going to be discussing here is does Dennis's shooting make up for Sky's break? And I think that's what this is ultimately going to come down to. The jumping of Sky, Dennis jumps the balls pretty good. Is it really a big, huge advantage? Dennis's, you know, cue ball, it's pretty tight. Sky's is pretty tight, too. Is that really going to be a huge difference? Probably a little bit, but not a huge amount. I think what it comes down to is Dennis's ability to run out and Sky's ability to break the ball so he doesn't really have to run out. I would add
one other factor, which is that Dennis outmoves him. I think he outmoves him.
Oh, as far as the safety play, yes. I could see that as well. So let me take this from there. That's really what this discussion is coming down to, and that's where I want to start it. As Dennis is going to be shooting, basically Dennis is going to be getting out just about every single time he gets to the table, for the most part, when he has an opportunity. So is Sky's break going to give Dennis enough opportunities to be able to win this match with firepower? It's really, really hard to say. Where I want to take this discussion from there is Sky had a baby, and I'm not one of those people who says, you know, Sky had a kid, there's no chance that, you know, he's going to be playing well anymore. I think that's just a silly argument to make for the most part. I think people's expectations, people's responsibilities change after they have a child. And just because you have a child does not mean that you're destined, you're destined to be a bad pool player anymore. I think that happens generally at the amateur level because pool is not their life. But Jason Shaw has two, maybe three kids, and really when he started getting really dominant is when he had his child. And I think that a lot of things just change in your psyche to where you're not playing for yourself anymore. You're playing for your family. You're playing for your livelihoods. I think that can be a very, very good thing for Sky Woodward as far as just giving him a greater perspective on what he's actually playing this game for. So I don't like the lazy argument of Sky had a kid, he's going to be a donkey now. I think that this is the first opportunity we're going to get to see where what does it actually mean, and not in a way that like, oh my God, he's going to be terrible. It's, is this going to be that situation where he has a greater respect on life, a greater reason to play, and he's going to, you know, dig deep and really find a way to be that top, top, top tier player that he hasn't quite broken through yet?
Yeah. So, I don't disagree with that. Like at some point, you know, Sky is maturing. He's been on the winning Moscone Cup team. He's been winning some international events that have, you know, the, like that Derby City. And he's been showing that he's really growing up, and then having another kid and being more experienced, he's ready to grow up and the lion's, you know, the lion's going to have his full mane and roar, take over the forest. Okay, I'm just going to tell you my thoughts on this match and how these things play together. I don't think Sky can win. I don't think the break edge is enough, and there's a few reasons why. Sky has not played the number of races to 100 for money. Like, Dennis, I don't know how many, you know, what the ratio of how much more money match experience Dennis has. But, you know, just in terms of overall money matches as well as race to 100s. But I know Dennis has probably played 10 to 20 races to 100, and maybe 10. And I know that he's played so many money sets, okay? He's played so many money matches that when there's one thing, and we talked about experience. But, man, Dennis, boy, he really knows how to play well under pressure and get the job done to win. So I got the experience edge cannot be understated. On top of that, he not only does he shoot better and run out higher percentage, but he moves better, and he moves better by a margin. I remember watching Shane and Alex play once where they did some statistics, and out of the games that both players got to shoot, Alex won like 70% of them against Shane. And this is like 2010. And it's like, that's what I think Dennis can do to the sky in the moving game. I think that the games that they both shoot, Dennis wins like 70%. It's just like, you know, and so it's all about opportunities to score times scoring percentage. Dennis is going to have a higher scoring percentage. So that means that Sky has to break so much better than Dennis that he has, you know, he really has to have such – it's got to be looking like Shane Van Boning playing somebody in 10 ball where he's popping the rock every time, back when other players were clipping off the rack with high inside and, you know, lucky to make a ball. Like, you would need to generate so many opportunities to score that you could make up for edges in every other category in terms of run out, moving, you know, experience, everything else. And the problem with the break is that it doesn't matter if you're not winning games. And so if Dennis is just sitting him in his chair and winning game after game after game after game, and Sky is just getting up there cold with an 8-game deficit down, you know, 18 to 10 and missing balls and trying to get shots, and Dennis is hooking them, and Dennis is just running out like a machine, his break doesn't save him from that. His break is good if he's a front runner. If he's able to be so explosive that he's just able to – I mean, he would just have to string so many racks together that he's always like, ha, 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 here's another 4-pack, here's another 6-pack, here's another 4-pack, to where even when Dennis fights back, he can laugh off all those edges. And the problem is, not only don't I believe that could happen, and I've thought about this one, I've been stewing on this one, I don't think that's in play. But then when you add in the 4.25 pockets, it just – any chance that you think that this break is going to save him goes away on 4.25-inch pockets. It just – Not happening in my book, even if they just recover the table. It's just, I don't see it. And so, I mean, if it was, boy, and the only way that this guy has can even make a match out of this, in my opinion, is if they recover the table the day before and Sky has that breakdown to a stop shot where he's getting 7-ball layouts with a, you know, with open, the same pattern, like a, some kind of gaffy Corey Duel, ha ha ha, you know, should be a legal type break. But like that aside, like even that, The thing is that Dennis can break the balls too. I just watched a video of Dennis running 5 racks with a template rack at Hard Times on the Gold Crowns with the shim pockets, and it was a little different break format. But the point is, Dennis knows how to break with a template. It's not like he's just gonna, you know, well, hit the balls hard and go off the table. I mean, he's okay got a game plan too.
If you're okay with me jumping in here, because there's one rule in here that I just find really, really, really interesting, and this screams Filipino to me. Like, I feel like this was absolutely put in place by a Filipino player. And I'm going to read this rule, and I said it already, but I really want to highlight it. The rule is no checking your opponent's rack. That is a really, really interesting. Why is that in place there? So the idea is you're using a template. What's the matter with checking your opponent's rack? Well, yes, Sky has his break set down perfectly, but I think Sky's break is set perfectly if the balls are tight, right? That wing ball doesn't go to the side if you have a giant gap between the head ball and the next ball, right?
I see where you're going with this, yeah.
So why is that rule in place if you're using a template rack? I think that there's something, maybe it's possible Dennis is using some, and I don't even want to say anything nefarious here because I really have no insider information. I have no idea. The rule could be there just for the randomness of it being there, but
just to assure the listeners that when they watch the stream, they're going to get to see pool and not arguments. Yes,
maybe. So it could be just that, but it seems like there might be a break. Maybe Dennis has that he's going to try, because if he thinks he's not going to be able to fade Sky's break, he's not going to take the game. So I think that there might be some sort of break that Dennis has as well, just to your point that he's going to be able to counteract Skies with, even if he can't hit it as good as Sky. I think he doesn't need to break as good as Sky, because that's Sky's edge. He just needs to break well enough to fade the shooting gap that he has over Sky.
Yeah, and like I said, I think that what we're going to see play out is we're going to see lopsided scores to where Sky is getting pounded by Dennis's airtight pattern and runout game and firepower. He's going to get outmoved when they need to move, and that his big break is not going to do him any good because he's never going to get to use it. And when he does get to the table to break, he's going to be down with a 2-1 score deficit where on tight pocketed tables where he could maybe make that break, but it's going to be hard for him to break as well when you're down 20-10 and frustrated than it is in your practice table. And even still, he's going to break the balls, and it's going to be tough for him to run out. And when he does run a rack or two, it's going to be too little too late, and then Dennis is going to pound on him some more, and it's going to get harder and harder for him. And I think that the moving game is going to be a decisive difference. I think that the run-out game is going to be a decisive difference, especially in 4.25-inch pockets. And as much as I love Sky, and I do love Sky's game, I love what he's doing, and I'm glad he's repping the U.S., but he's tugging on Superman's cape here, man. Dennis Arcolo is the only reason. I mean, he plays with Shane, man. The only reason Shane beats him playing 10 balls because of that 10 ball break of Shane's. You know, if they played, I guarantee you, if they played, you know, wood rack 10 ball on a hard times gold crown with shim pockets, like, Shane don't have to win that game. Like, as far as I'm concerned, Sky is playing, is one of the, you know, is a player who's as good as anybody in the world playing money matches. And it's like, you're going to need more than a trick break in a race to 100 with tight pockets. That's my opinion.
So I think that we discussed this one pretty well. It's not until September, I think, 4th through the 7th is when this one is. So I'm sure we'll get a couple more discussions in on this, maybe when we have a little bit more information on it. But it's not for another month, so we have a little time. So let's just leave this discussion there, and we will move on to the end of the podcast. We can go into my tip for this week. Actually, I guess we have plenty of listener questions now. The listeners have been crushing it on those. So let us take on a listener question this week. And this is a listener question from Clint Schmid. And it is, Fargo rate seems to be a universal language for player handicap nowadays. In my area, tournament directors aren't motivated to use this or any other method for handicapping, so all of the tournaments are open. I personally don't have a problem with this, but I know for a fact that it keeps lower players from even considering competing in these weekly events. My question is, should I try to convince these guys to use Fargo? Or as a player that is more likely higher than the magical 550 number, referring to the concerns on the podcast, am I just asking for trouble? So I guess the gist of this question is this... Clint is a better player, and he is concerned, I guess, about Fargo rate and how it's not being used in his area. And he thinks that with Fargo rate, he thinks that that would create potentially more participation amongst lower quality players, but it would also delegate him out of the game at the same exact time because he's too high of the number that are going to be really segregated out for. So. If you don't mind, I'm going to take this one on first because
please
not even a player anymore these days when it comes to these events. Fargo rate, so it depends ultimately as what do you think you want for the game? And what I mean by that is Wisconsin right now has tournaments every single weekend for every single range except for my range and above, basically. So the idea is each of these tournaments gets 20, 30, 40, 50, sometimes as many as 64 players for a 525 and under. And is that worth, in the long run, the benefit, or maybe I should reword it this way, does the benefits towards pool having 64 players under 525, is that worth it in the long run to help grow the game, or are we at a crossroads where it just incentivizes casual play, and casual play, as we've seen for 20 years in the country, doesn't actually promote pool. It just kind of allows it to exist and kind of I don't know, maybe bubble on the back burner without actually growing at all. And that is a serious debate, I think, that we could have. And that's kind of where I see this is, does casual play on the weekends with a bunch of casual players who maybe they want to get better, maybe they don't, but they really just don't want to get their nuts kicked into, you know, a top player. Does the tournaments, the isolated tournaments that give them a real chance of winning a tournament and making some money, does that grow the game, or does that just make a bunch of content players who now they have a hobby on the weekend that they can make a little bit of money at while having some fun, but not actually give back to the game in any sort of meaningful way? That's basically the way that I see this debate. Is that, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think it's a really, like you said, we could either touch it or we could go in depth. And right now we're just touching it. So all I can say is 100% agreed that's a big debate.
So that's, I guess, essentially how I see this question. Now to answer it, I'm answering this with, and I'm a mathematician. Anybody who listens to this podcast knows that I have a degree in theoretical mathematics. So I look at things extremely analytically, and I don't generally like to make broad sweeping claims on things that I just don't have data on. And I don't have any data on this. Wisconsin is one of the, per capita, I think we're actually the most used Fargo rating state, meaning we have more Fargo rate events per capita than any other state in the country. And that makes sense because we've been using it actually before Fargo rate even existed. We had another, basically, it was basically Fargo rate before it was Fargo rate, called My Pool Stats, which Chris Bondi ran. And basically, it is the same exact thing as Fargo rate. It just existed about 4 years before Fargo rate existed. So we've been using these systems for so long, and maybe that's why we are actually getting more numbers. Now, the little bit of data that I do have is these Monday night things that I've been doing for free. So I'm giving free lessons to anybody who wants to show up for 3 hours every single Monday, and I've done it for 5 weeks straight now. And I have a solid group of five players that show up every single week, and they have showed up every single week. There are then a cycling number of about six or seven people that also come through. Sometimes none of them show up, sometimes one of them, sometimes five of them, sometimes seven of them. So I do have a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of data there that shows that there are a couple players, at least, in this lower tiered range. I think the highest player I have is a 575, and then I have a 530, and then the rest are right around 500 to maybe a little bit lower than 500. And I'm not getting any players above 600. I have not had a player above 600. Sometimes that is an ego thing. What the heck can somebody, what can one of my peers teach me that I don't already know? And there's definitely an ego thing that goes into that. But there's also, you know, there also is the debate whether or not those players are so far removed from pool because they're not allowed to play anymore that what's the point of getting better and what's the point of practicing on your game? That I'm not going to venture down. But in a population that uses Fargo rate more than any other state in the country, and I could still only get 6 to 8 players every single week for a free, not professional lesson, but you know, I think I'm pretty decent at it. I think I'm a good teacher.
I've seen your. I was looking at the agenda for last night, and I know that what we talked about and what we were texting back and forth. Like I know what you were doing. I've seen your videos. Like you're doing for the people that, yeah, you offer a ton of value. To only get 5 people, it's a little sad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it almost makes me wonder if you charge money if you get more. But anyway, that's a different conversation.
That could be. So I guess to go back to the heart of this question, I do honestly think that there is a lot of engagement in 550 and under level players, but I don't think that those are the types of players that want to get better. There are definitely pockets of them that, you know, they do want to get better, and they're using these as a vehicle to put themselves through the grind and put themselves through the stressful situations so that they can really get the experience to better their game and really use it as a stepping stool to get better. But I think the vast majority of players that are playing in these capped events, while yes, they're going to show up and they're going to play on the weekend to try to take their stab at $1,300 first place for, you know, a Calcutta, I don't think that these are the people that give back to the game. I don't think that, honestly, they are interested necessarily in promoting the future of the game. I think they're more centralized towards the, advancing of maybe their pocketbook in an event that they see that they can win and do well in it. And that's kind of a bleak outlook on, I guess, the way that these Fargo events are, but that's the small amount of data that I have thus far. They're not necessarily interested, at least to take advantage of a free resource, to better their game. But they're more than willing to show up 2 days prior to any event in the entire state and travel 2 hours to do it. They're not willing to come out on a Monday night for a free session and try to better their game that way. So that's the small amount of data that I see thus far. And maybe that changes in a couple of weeks. Maybe it doesn't. Who knows? But that's kind of where I see that the players that are participating in these capped events, they really aren't giving back to the game in any sort of major way or trying to necessarily better their game in anything I could possibly do to get better kind of way. So I don't necessarily think that incorporating Fargo-rated events, while it's going to increase participation, I don't think that that's participation that really betters anything in the game.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, one thing about the number of people and how you don't get many people is you don't get many people at that level wanting to train and take the game seriously and go all in, because the people that have that attitude stay at that level so short of a time. They get better so much faster that quickly they're not at that level anymore. So most of the people at that level are people that aren't all in, otherwise they wouldn't be at that level. So you only get a few people that are temporarily at that level on their way up. You know what I mean? It's just not where people stay.
Yeah. Can I jump in there really quick? I heard this from an old timer, and it's such an appropriate thing and you're going to like this, Demetrius. The ability to go from a 400 level player to a 450 level player is nothing more than a decision to do it. The person going from a 450 to 500 is nothing more than the decision to do it. 500 to 550 is nothing more than the decision to do it. The jump from 700 to 750 is nothing more than the decision to do it. Meaning, if you have the expectation that you're going to get better, you don't stay at the same level you're at. You go up and you go up immediately. It doesn't take long, but it's hard to get yourself to mentally buy into actually doing it, because generally speaking, you know what it's going to take. But once you decide that you're willing to give up what it takes to do it, you go fast. You go really fast.
It reminds me, when I was a sales trainer and a sales manager, I used to tell my sales guys, I'm like, it takes like 30 to 60 days to get to the number one position. It takes about 10 seconds to make up your mind and about 30 days for the deals to roll in. Like, it's just not that hard. You know what I mean?
And that's what it is. I mean, the decision to get from any level to the next level, it doesn't take working on your break. It doesn't take working on your cue ball. It doesn't take working on your jumping or banking or kicking. It takes the decision to do it. That's all it takes.
Yes, and then everything else comes together. No, oh, you're right. So here's my thought on the question. I look at it a little differently, because I look at it from a player perspective, and I'm in some ways, I'm joking. I'm saying I'm terrible for the game. I'm not, because now I'm doing these boot camps, and it's awesome. But I think as a player first, and as a player, I sort everything out into two categories. Are these things that I can control, things that I can't control? Are these things that are helping me reach my target or not? And when I hear trying to get, like, I was just kind of going off on tournament directors using funny rule sets and asking for trouble. Like, I'm not out there trying to change them. I'm not like writing these guys emails and being like, you know, in a non-referee match. It's like, no, out of my control, out of my control, out of my control, out of my control. Not helping me get where I need to be, not helping me get where I need to be. I am laser focused on where I want to be and only putting energy into things that are moving me towards my goal. So as a player, the idea of bickering with some tournament director about handicaps and Fargo rate, like, why would I do that? I have, first of all, it's not taking me towards my goal. Secondly, it's not even in my control. Now, maybe it's my sphere of influence. But, like, listen, my whole thought is, if you want to be a good player, just play. And just do what's going to make you a better player and help you hit your goals. Now, that being said, if in addition to playing, you want to give back to the game and develop the game, then you have to figure out, is this, like Nate's saying, is this even a good thing to go to Fargo rate? And if so, are you better off arguing with some, you know, power hungry, thinks he knows it all, local tournament director guy? Or are you better off just doing something on your own to try to promote pool? And that's up to you. I'm not convinced that this is best for pool, and I'm not convinced that you're going to win an argument with a tournament director that, you know, either one of those things seem unlikely, although I haven't met the guy. Maybe he's really open-minded and humble and willing to sit down and listen intently to what your suggestions are. Like, maybe that's possible, but I just, well, from what I've seen, most people don't fall in that category. So I just say, you know, here's my opinion. use your years of playing to play. And then when you get a little older and you're not, you know, you're not going to be playing competitively, that's your time to get back. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and that's fine on an isolated – that's fine, I guess, on an isolated case-by-case basis. But if we have – in my mind, if we have – if you're basically taking – if you're getting an open tournament and you're getting 64 players and then you decide to start running handicap events and now you're getting 128 players, those 64 players – have dedicated their lives to this game, and they're dedicated every single, you know, they're the people showing up at the pool halls on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, practicing. Those are the people who are constantly in action, constantly, you know, paying greens fees, buying lunch, buying drinks. The what I see is the players that are coming in for these 525 and unders, 550 and unders, whatever they are. Yes, some of them are in the bars just like some of the open players are. But what's happening is the players are just showing up for the weekend playing from what I'm seeing. And I'm at the Rock Sports Bar and Grill a lot. I'm at the Ballroom a lot in Wisconsin. And I'm seeing that the open players who play in the open events are there regardless, except for when you delegate them completely out. Now you're not seeing these open players anymore,
which were the biggest staples. And I'll tell you what, you and I are on different sides of this for a few reasons, because you are actually really playing a role in shaping – You have a lot of influence in the pool community, and you're really passionate about the pool community. And so, and I agree. Listen, as a player who is, you know, for those that haven't heard me say this before, I mean, I'm a strong player in my region and in Minnesota, and I don't play in Minnesota. People, I get asked, I just got a private message on Easy Billiard. Hey, do you ever go to the Friday night tournament at CRs? I'm like, no, I don't play in Minnesota. Like, I'm done. Like, I've basically been kind of done with Minnesota pool for 5 years now, where it's like everything's bar tables, everything's handicapped, everything's Fargo capped. And I'm just like, you know what? I used to try to go play some bar table handicap stuff and then give up 3 games to 8 to these guys running tables and trying to fight my way through these Calcuttas when I'm giving up. It's like, I just – and then play on 7-footers with big pockets. I'm like, you know what? This isn't what I want to do. I'm a good player. So, let me just finish. So, for me – I think that for top players, I'm proving the point that for good players, these Fargo caps and these Fargo rate handicap tournaments, they certainly put off good players. And I'm not mad about it. I'm not bitter. I'm just like, I would be mad and bitter if I tried to play these events and kept getting, you know, feeling like I was kicked out and feeling like I'm not giving back. But now I'm just like, no, I just look at it like tournaments happen like at the national level for me. And I just feel like, I don't think it's good for – anyway, now I'm starting – maybe you got to cut all this out, because now I'm starting to get into the debate about whether I think this is good for the game or not, I'm not convinced
That's exactly what my point is, actually, is when you have just these open tournaments, your open tournament players, meaning the people who are willing to play in an open tournament, those, from my experience, tend to be the players who show up on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and they support the bars whether it's a pool tournament or not. What I'm seeing is when you delegate these players out, you now lose them. Because what are they practicing for? They have no reason to practice anymore. So they're not showing up to the pool rooms anymore on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and they're not buying drinks, and they're not buying food, and they're not supporting the places. Well, that's fine as long as you know, if you have a 64-person tournament or you have 4 550 and unders, and they're all filling at 64. You're increasing the player pool by 4 times that are playing regularly. But if you don't have some of those players showing up to take the place of these open players, yes, the weekends might be better. Your numbers might be better on the weekends. But all of those players who were there every single day, basically supporting your place, are no longer showing up because they have no reason to. They have nothing to practice for. And if that's not taking place of these players that are playing in the 550 and unders, and some players that play in the open are still playing in the 550 and unders, so those players will still show up. You know, there's a lot of players at 500 Fargo that just want to play the game. And they're considered, I would consider them open tournament players. But these players that are coming in that'll only play if it's a 550 and under, I think you're losing a lot of business, because I just don't personally see these guys showing up to the bar during the week and supporting the pool halls. So
you're right. And there's one other factor that you didn't mention, but just tied right in. When I got into playing pool, what inspired me to want to get good, to where I lived at the pool hall for 5 years, was I got to watch the top players, and they got to walk around and win tournaments and win money and be treated with respect and be treated like celebrities. And like, they got to play the big money matches behind roped off tables, and everybody would watch and pull up chairs. and there was a social prestige for being, and there was a small financial payoff, but there was a payoff for being at the top, both in terms of winning tournaments, winning money, being respected, being admired. And it was like, wow, someday I want to be like that guy. Now, and so that draws people into the game because people are like, I want to be that guy. Yeah. Now the reward for getting good is to get kicked out and not get to play anymore, or to have a bunch of people get three games on the wire and laugh about how you're not so tough on a bar table with a three-game spot. Now, ha, ha, ha. And then even the times that there are a few tournaments where they're playing in the finals, people aren't watching them anyway because they're like, why would I want to watch you play? I could go watch, you know, Sky Woodward and Dennis live on TV or live on YouTube. So therefore, why would, or pay-per-view, why would I want to watch you? So it's like, I think to me, what if you want to talk about short-term success by bringing people in on the weekend, there's also a penalty, which is how many people are you drawing into the game for the next generation? And if there's no reward for – if there's nobody to look up to and be like, that guy, I want to be where he is. Like right now, what? I want to be a – you know, I don't know. It's like what – I just don't know that you're going to draw people into the game with this model. So not only are you filling up weekends but burning your days, but I don't even think you're – I think you're filling up the short term, but I just don't see how it's growing the sport.
That's about where I am too. So I think that was a really – well, that was a really long discussion on this, but I think it's a good question. I think it's a really good question because I think there's a lot of states and there's a lot of tournament directors and there's a lot of regions that are battling with these same questions. And I think that for the most part, Wisconsin is completely 100% bought into the Fargo rate debate on this side. They fall onto the having cap tournaments all over the place, and very, very rarely will they ever have an open tournament. And I mean... You're kind of close, but you're not necessarily plugged into the pool world because you checked out a long time ago. The best players in Wisconsin, the only time you generally see them play anymore, I mean, unless you're like a Jeremy Fedkenauer who just can't get enough of the game and he plays all the time and he'll play anybody anytime, you don't see these top players unless it's the state tournament anymore. And even then, some of them aren't showing up because what they haven't played, they haven't dusted off their cues and you know, almost a year since the last tournament. So what's the point in playing in something at, you know, you can't get to your top level of your game if you're not playing and if you're not having events to play in, what's the point of playing? So I think we're losing a lot of these top players to basically just being stale. There's just no reason to play anymore.
And I do want to say it's nothing about Fargo rate itself. I'm a big fan of Fargo rate and supporting Mike.
It's about the application what
you do
with it.
And to your point, I mean, in a dream world, what you do is you'd have Fargo capped tournaments to bring in numbers, and then you would siphon a percentage of that money and use that as an added purse to encourage people to step up into open tournaments, or you could do different things like that. Anyway, not my cup of tea to figure all that out, but I agree with what you're saying.
I hope that was a good discussion for you, Clint, and I really appreciate the listener question. We have a couple more of them, but absolutely we have a queue going, so reach out if you have any questions yourself. I think any questions like that, I think they're really, really good, fun discussions, and I think they're, you know, they can really open up some insight into maybe how to use Fargo in your area. So we'll leave it there, and we can go into the Coach's Corner.
All right, welcome to another edition of the Coach's Corner, part of the podcast where I, Demetrius Gelatis, get to talk about pool with you all. For more information, you can check out my website about my three-day boot camps at www.mnpoolbootcamp.com. And I do want to mention, this is a part three of a series, and if you haven't heard part one and part two, I've actually clipped, for those of you guys that don't know, I've clipped all these Coach's Corners and put together a playlist on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and go to MN Pool Bootcamp and search that, you'll find my channel. Now, there's no video at this point. It's all just audio only. It's all just clips from this podcast. But that way, I've just got all the Coach's Corners right next to each other so you can check them out. And that's important on this because this is part three of a series about handling adversity, mental adversity. And so part one was about our attitude towards adversity. Part two was starting to identify the types of adversity that we're up against mentally. And part three is going to be, and as well as part two also had a blanket, the first line of defense on how to overcome it. And now this is part three where I'm going to talk about some specific challenges to come up. And we're going to use the tools that we've talked about, the first couple, to actually overcome these things here. So what you could expect is going to be a few more parts because I'm going to do some deep dives. We've got, you know, four or five different
situations that arise in tournament play that put a lot of pressure on you sometimes. And so I want to talk about those situations. And here's the format. I will talk about the general situation. I will give you a story of something that happened to me personally. And then I will give you what I do in those situations and how I look at that in gameplay. So for this week, I want to just talk about the pressure of expectation. So we've already tried our first line of defense that we heard from last episode, which is just to challenge it. But I will tell you a story. So specifically, I was playing back when I played leagues. This was a while back, but I was playing in a team tournament and five-man teams, and we got to the finals of this league playoff or whatever, and it was round robin, 25 games, race to 13 games at 8-ball. And it went 12-12, and so I had the last game. And I remember getting up to the table, and, you know, I got a chance to run out, and I ran down to the 8-ball. But unfortunately, I left myself pretty close to the side rail. I was going to be bridged off the side rail, and I'm cutting the 8-ball in the corner. Anyway, I don't need to describe the shot. What's important is it looked like an easy shot, except that I was bridged from right off the rail. And under normal circumstances, on a bar table, that would still be a pretty routine shot. But this is Hill Hill, and if I fumble here, and it was a little bit of a cut. Like, I'm cutting it a little bit, and it's just, you know, the diamond top pockets and everything. Like, I'm cutting it just a little. And in that moment, it didn't look easy. And I remember thinking to myself, all right, I should be able to make this. But I felt a ton of pressure, and I just didn't feel good on the ball. And I'm like, something bad's about to happen. And so everything I'm about to say went through my head in like 3 seconds. Like, I started to realize, what do I want to have happen here? And it's like, man, I more than anything, and this is, I was a lot younger then, I was like, I really wanted to make this ball and just show everybody that I'm a champion, that I'm the guy that makes the 8-ball under pressure, that I'm clutch, that when it's hill-hill and you have an 8-ball, that I'm the guy that makes it. You know, you got all these guys that dog the 8-ball, and they're the guys that dog it, and they're the guys that fall apart under pressure. And then you've got the champions, and the champions are people that make this ball under pressure, and they come with it. And I'm like, I want to show everybody and myself that I'm the guy that makes this 8-ball. That's what I want. And I remember thinking, I should be able to make this. And then I just stopped, and I'm like, what does that mean? I should be able to make this. Like, that doesn't really make sense. And it occurred to me that this is, like, under pressure, this is a tough shot. Like, I've seen top players miss shots like this. And so am I thinking that I'm so much better than they are, that I'm never going to miss this ball, but they are? And then I realized something else, which is, should. Like, I never think to myself, I should be able to make that shot when it's a hanger. Like, when I see a hanging ball, I don't get to the table and be like, I should be able to make this. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, should only comes up when you're in doubt. It's actually an attempt to talk yourself into feeling a certain way. You don't actually say it when you're confident. It's a sign of a lack of confidence. In fact, when you say I should be able to do something, it's kind of the opposite. It's like, I don't know if I can do this. And so I think about how many times should comes up, you know. Oh, I should have beat him. I should have made that. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I should have done this. That shouldn't have happened. This should have happened. Like, should. I think it's the most common word in pool. And so I started kind of thinking about all this. And then I'm like, what am I trying to do? You know, because I'm trying to prove, you know, it's like I've got 5 guys on my opponent's team that are rooting against me to make this ball, and they want to see me miss it. I've got 3 guys on my team that want to see me make this ball. I've got 1 guy on my team who kind of wants to see me make the ball because he'd like to win, but he might think I'm a little too cocky, so he wouldn't mind seeing me dog it. And I'm like, I'm thinking about like what each of them are thinking. And I had this vision of me making this 8-ball and everybody high-fiving me and telling me how clutch I am. And I realized I'm not. I'm not clutch. Because if I was clutch, I wouldn't be going through all these thoughts right now. And so I realized, I'm like, I am not the champion that just shoots this ball in fearlessly. Because if I was the champion that shot this ball in fearlessly, I would have already shot. And furthermore, that champion doesn't exist because everybody chokes sometimes. So this fantasy about being some invincible player, that fantasy is not a reality. And there's no way to, that's not who I am. And meanwhile, if I miss this shot, it doesn't mean that I'm a dog because everybody misses these shots. Like, I finally figured that out. And so I stopped and I said, well, what do I want? And the answer is, I'm not trying to convince myself I'm something I'm not, and then trying to convince other people I'm something I'm not so I can use their conviction that I trick them into believing that I'm something that I'm not so that I can kind of pretend that I am too because they all play along with me. It's like, no, that's not what I'm here to do. What I'm here to do is actually wrestle with these thoughts and try to overcome these and be let go of the temptation, to let go of the temptation of reaching for this fantasy. And instead, just be in the here and now, which is, I might miss it, I might miss it. It doesn't define me, but the goal is to do my best to pocket this ball and to do my best to let go of these temptations. Not even to let go of these temptations, but to do my best to let go of them. My job is to just do that. And so I did. I'm like, whatever happens, I'm okay with it. Because I no longer have an illusion that I'm trying to protect, that I'm some infallible player. I've let go of that. I'm not an infallible player. Let's just see what happens. And I shot it and went in. And then everybody's like, oh, you're so clutch. You're so clutch. That's why you're a champion. And I'm like, I'm not buying into it. Like, you guys could buy into that. You guys can tell me that. But I know the truth, which is I could have dogged that ball. And I do dog balls. And I'm not some I'm not some stolen champion that's infallible. That, yes, I can run out sometimes. But I'm just me. And it just happened to go in that time. I didn't buy into the myth because I'd let go of that. And so what I've talked about, the best way to explain it would be when you are trying to grasp for something that's not true, when you are trying to be someone you're not, when you are really trying to convince other people or yourself that you're something you're not, it leads to a fear of exposure. It leads to fear of exposure. And so the story I use, I told the story of what happened, but here's a little anecdote I made up to explain this to somebody once. I said, suppose you're at a party and you start talking to some girl, and she starts talking to you and you're flirting with her a little bit and you use some line, you have some like French saying that you know where you're like, da-da. And then she gets all excited. She's like, oh, I don't speak French. Do you know how to speak French? And she gets like really excited. Like, I've always wanted to learn. And just in that moment, you can't help yourself. And you're like, of course I speak French. I mean, someone as sophisticated as moi, of course. Yeah, of course I speak French. And so, and everything's great. You know, you're like, and then she's all excited. Anyway, you move on, you forget about it, you talk. Well, you end up seeing her again, and you get together, and you start dating. And next thing you know, it's like a month later, and she invites you. She's like, hey, my parents are at this cafe, and we're having breakfast. They come on by. They'd love to meet you. So you're like, all right. So you come on by, and she points out her parents when she meets you at the door, and she's walking into the table, and she's like, my mom, she's going to love you. She grew up in France. And all of a sudden, you're going to be like, oh, that's right. Son of a... I told her I speak French. And all of a sudden, there's this, like, panic that's like, oh, God darn it. Now what? Now how am I going to get out of this? You know, because you've pretended to be something you're not. And now there's this comedic, you know, Seinfeld-like situation brewing where how are you going to, you know, now you got to, like, but of course, you're supposed to just come clean and be like, yeah, I was, you know. But if you try to pretend, right? Like if you try to like double down and be like, no, I do speak French. I'm going to trick her mom. I'm just going to say I'm a little rusty and I prefer not to speak French. Or like, it's just going to get ugly if you try to act like you can do something you can't. And so the best way to handle that would be not to pretend in the first place that you can speak French. And when she says, oh, do you speak French? You say, no, just, you know, whatever, just that line. So the point is that fear comes from fear of exposure. And so when I'm in a situation where I feel that type of pressure on me, the way I identify it is with that red flag word, should. When I start hearing the word should in my head, I know that that is the attack I'm up against. And so whenever I hear myself thinking the word should, I just say to myself, I don't speak French. Like, nope, no, that's not true. Should is a sign of a false idea of a false expectation or of a imaginary, a fantasy. It's a fantasy that I'm the guy that should be able to do this. And so I just remind myself, I don't speak French. And then I go back to my process goals, you know, take a deep breath, put a good swing on, enjoy the battle, things like that. Things I can control, things that I'm actually here to do. And so the word should is one flag. This also comes up if you're ever trying to prove something to somebody. I want to prove that I'm the kind of player that could beat him. I want to prove that he's trying to shark me. I want to prove that that's not going to bother me. Or I want to prove that I'm a better player. It's like anything where you're like, you know, it's like, well, maybe not. I don't know. For me, that's all result stuff. And so when I start feeling like I've got an image of who I want to be, and I'm not okay with reality because I'm really, really wanting to prove that something other than reality is true. That's where I use that I don't speak French. Or alternatively, I do have a dumb friend named Tom who shot himself in the leg with his gun. So if you, for those of you that have seen 8 Mile and the of course, the final rap battles and how Eminem, dissed himself and pulled the fangs on his opposition, and then by admitting his own mortality and vulnerability and fallibility, he actually elevated himself. That's my mentality is, you know what, I'm not this tough guy that's going to win this rap battle. I'm just this guy that grew up in a trailer trash, and I do have a dumb friend named Tom who shot himself in the gun with his own gun. It's like, that's it. So I use either I don't speak French or I do have a dumb friend named Tom. Like, those are my two battles when I start trying to prove that I'm something I'm not. And the way that I realize that I'm trying to prove something I'm not is negative emotions and usually the word should. So hopefully that helps. So that's scenario one. The word should, I think of that story, I use that counter, and then I move on and try to shoot the balls in. So in the future, I have 3 or 4 other situations that come up around like playing better players or different things that happen a lot in pool when you're kind of nervous. So, but for now, so this is part 3. Parts 1 and 2, again, you can hear on YouTube, mnpoolbootcamp.com. Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. Talk to you guys soon.
All right. Another great coach's corner. Lots of things to be learned in there. Demetrius, we lost Rob. Hopefully we find him at some point in time in the next week and we'll get him back on. But it's still a pleasure to be able to do the podcast with you.
Thanks, Nate. I can't wait to get together and hit some balls. So keep up the good work on Monday nights. And for those of you guys in Wisconsin, get on over there. Learn. Get better. This game. If you're going to play the game, play the game. All right.
Yeah. All right. Take care, everybody.
Later.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.
realize that she's a girl that I always watch her. My heart. Please don't ever let this feeling go away.